You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need. You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
This is Amber Rose Washington, music producer and author of the best-selling book, Hiding from Myself. And you're listening to the Ghosts in the Valley podcast.
Hello and welcome to Ghost in the Valley podcast. I'm your host, Al Cooley. Over the next 3 weeks, I'm going to do a special on the UFOs over the Berkshires. This was a 8-part series I ran 5 years ago. So we're going to have the people behind the scenes, the stars of the show that was released on Netflix through the Unsolved Mysteries series. And today we're going to focus on Doug Sackman. He was the arts director of the Berkshires UFO. Doug was involved with the special effects and many of the aspects in the movie business. Doug passed away last year. The first part of today's show I'm going to dedicate to Doug Sackman. Then right after Doug Sackman will be Justin Janowitz. Justin was the director of photography, and he shares his experiences on filmmaking and being part of the Unsolved Mysteries episodes. And right after Justin Janowitz will be the director of the Unsolved Mysteries show, UFOs Over the Berkshires, Marcus Clark. Here are 3 parts of that 8-part series, UFOs Over the Berkshires.
Thank you, Doug, for being on the show today. I appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks for reaching out.
Yeah, going through your credits, I've seen you have quite an impressive resume with over 40 feature films you were involved with.
Yeah, I kind of go back and forth between television, music videos, and feature films. I've actually produced over 45 feature films. I don't know if you looked at my IMDb or my website, but a lot of the stuff I have done isn't up there as well. You know, it's just more of my, I guess, more mainstream stuff or more recognizable stuff, I guess.
Right. I've seen the feature films and TV and music videos, short films, commercials. I mean, almost with all of it.
I've been in the business for 20 years, and it's the entertainment industry has always fascinated me. And then also, you know, I have a special interest in horror and sci-fi and supernatural and aliens and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, for it to culminate in working on Unsolved Mysteries after 20 years of production was pretty incredible, because I grew up watching the show, huge fan of, you know, the original. I jumped at the opportunity when they called me for this. It was kind of, you know, just by working on other things, I got recommended for it as art director, because one of my friends was directing one of the episodes, actually just happened happened to be, and they liked what I was doing so much, so they just kept me on for the whole series.
Yeah, so you're quite experienced on the special effects also.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of go back and forth between my two main, my passion is just making movies and you know, film projects in general, but special effects is definitely, special effects and production design are the two, I guess, artful. Yeah, I get my hands dirty, and I can do more stuff with and be more creative with that, those elements of it. But I do direct and produce and, you know, kind of put together projects from scratch. So a little bit of everything. I just love the art of, you know, putting together projects like this, you know.
They're about 30 years ago, I had my own video production company, and I did a couple short films. And I know the work involved in putting all that together yourself, you know. So I was casting director, you know, the whole nine yards. And I had a friend of mine that was into special effects, and I never really got into that. I ended up that side of it until I seen there was a part they were working on. I don't know, you maybe can help me out on this. There was a scene and there was a nudity, and for them to take it down a rating, they brought in a synthetic breast, you know. It looked real. I mean, if you looked at because they did it from the face down to the stomach. If you looked at the person and looked at the synthetic person they made, it was, and they brought it down a rating because it wasn't the actual body. I don't know.
Well, I mean, if you're trying to get a rating, you know, the ratings board is just totally out of whack. The standards are more, you know, if you, you know, it's a studio movie or you're putting money behind it, and, you know, the standards get totally out of whack. You know, like, for instance, I work for Troma Entertainment, which is probably the oldest independent movie studio in the world at this point, 46 years. You know, worked outside of the studio system. They created the Toxic Avenger, Sergeant Kabuki Man, NYPD, Class of Nukem High. And, you know, I got my career, you know, I started as an actor in 1997, 1998, and worked on one of their movies, actually the fourth Toxic Avenger movie, Citizen Toxie, as an actor. And that was where I kind of saw you could get more involved behind the scenes, because I had worked on some bigger budget stuff as, you know, a featured background or, you know, TV show stuff here and there. But when I got involved with Troma, you know, I actually got involved with the special effects. I got involved with the production of the thing. And by the end of it, well, you know, I kind of just came on as an apprentice. So I ended up getting a associate producer credit on it. And you know, I'm working with them currently to this day. I just co-produced their last movie called Shakespeare Shitstorm. Hashtag Shakespeare Shitstorm. And that actually comes out this Friday.
Awesome.
It's a adaptation of Shakespeare's The Tempest and a follow-up to Romeo and Juliet, which Troma released in 1996. So it's, you know, Shakespeare the way it was intended through the eyes of the Troma team and Lloyd Kaufman. If you know Troma, you'll know what that means, I guess. ShakespeareShitstorm.com is the website, and we're going to be doing drive-ins across the nation over the next month and a half, 2 months. The world premiere is at the Fantasia Film Festival this Friday, and it's virtual. It's the biggest sci-fi and horror film festival in North America, but due to COVID, it's all online. So anyone in the United States and Canada can watch it. If you go to ShakespeareShitstorm.com or Troma.com or Fantasia Film Festival, you type into Google, it'll come up. It's all over. There's a lot of articles and links to the tickets, and you can buy tickets. I think they're, you know, $20 or something, and you can see the world premiere from the comfort of your own home. So,
well, Fantasia, that takes me back a bit. That was a very good movie. I liked that one a lot.
Yeah, well, this festival has been around for, I think, 30 years. I mean, Fantasia, the movie, has been around for 45, longer than that. And actually, I'm a huge fan of that movie. It's probably where they got the inspiration for the name, but this is just, you know, a festival of hundreds of genre movies over a month. That actually started like a week or so ago. So it's going to be going through middle of September. So those guys are really good. We've been showing a lot of movies there for years. So I would definitely check that out. FantasiaFilmFestival.com, I think, is the website.
Oh, for sure. Do you find out that working with music videos is just as difficult as a feature film?
Definitely not. I mean, sometimes it is, depending on the technical stuff you're trying to do with it, but it's much shorter. A feature film, you know, is a dedication of 3 to 6 months, if not longer, depending on, you know, how involved you are with it, or, you know, how much money the thing has and how long you can work on it. But music videos, Usually it's a 3 to 5 day shoot would be the maximum I've ever done a music video. Usually it's 1 or 2 days, you know, but you put a lot of time and production into those few days to make it look as good as a feature film, but it's only 3 to 5 minutes long, whereas a feature film is an hour and a half. So, you know, not to say I worked on a music video where it was 1 day of shooting and it took us almost a year of post-production because everything was completely composited together and it was all done, you know, by myself and a few friends that, you know, weren't working on it full time. It was kind of spare time over a year, compositing it all together. And that one's actually called The AKA's Get It Together. You can see that on my YouTube page, Doug Sackman on YouTube and all social media, basically, S-A-K-M-A-N-N.
Like you're working on a music video. Is that like, is just everything like special effects or is it directing?
Usually on music videos, I get hired to either produce and do special effects or direct. So I directed the last music video for Cannibal Corpse, which I did the special effects. I shot it. I was in it, produced it. This music video for the AKAs I directed, that was quite a number of years ago, but it was you know, one of the more technical things I worked on. And I directed that and produced it and co-edited it with my friend David Poplow. And then I produced a series of music videos for Motion City Soundtrack. And this music video called True Romance was something that, you know, the concept was brought to me by our friends at Dead Horse Films. And they hired me and my friends because they couldn't figure out, you know, the logistics of how to do it. We had to join forces because it's a 1 4.5 minute shot. It's all done in one shot, but it's all in reverse. So the actors are acting backwards and it takes place over 2 city blocks and it's a very technical thing. So, you know, something, you know, because it was a low budget thing and we're all kind of just trying to make it happen. It was like a week and a half, 2 weeks to do that video, but only one day, one rehearsal day and one shoot day, you know? So it really depends on the situation, you know? Obviously money is a huge factor in a lot of this stuff, but I mean, a lot of, you know, it's more passion too. You have to be passionate about what you're doing to really, you know, find a way to make it work, you know? And I work with a lot of different people on a lot of different projects and I see, you know, different levels of passion. Sometimes it's more about the money. It's more about making, just being involved with something like that, you know, not really even about what you're making. For me, it's, you know, all about what's going on the screen and what's going into making that happen, you know, no matter what it takes. Obviously, you know, you gotta make sure people are compensated and you know, treated fairly and all that kind of stuff. But you also want to make sure you're getting the best thing possible with whatever resources you have, you know.
We'll be right back with Doug talking about his experience on Berkshire's UFO.
Learned with a phone one here, otherwise known as Charles, and you can find me on Instagram and Twitter. But I also host a podcast called Nerd with a Phone Podcast, and the number one question any podcaster gets, what is your podcast about? Well, I cover entertainment, news, music, video games, television, comic books, and other hobbies. We say get nerdified. What does it mean? It means we get happy. All right. Check out Nerd with a Phone Podcast on IndieBlastNetwork.com.
You know, now getting up to the Unsolved Mysteries that was just released through Netflix, the Berkshire's UFO. It had to be exciting to work alongside the originals, like, you know, Terry Dunn and Robert Wise.
I mean, yeah, it really was incredible. It was something that, you know, 12-year-old me or, you know, even 9, 10-year-old me would never imagined, you know, watching that show back then that I'm going to be, you know, literally working alongside these people. You know, Bob, you know, Robert Weiss directed some of the parts of the episodes and I worked with him to recreate, you know, even stuff for that first episode there, The Mystery on the Rooftop. And it was, you know, it was incredible. It was life-changing in a way too, because I've been doing a lot of different true crime stuff and supernatural stuff and reality TV for years, but even just working with them, you know, them being in the industry for 35, 40 years themselves, yeah, I learned so much from them.
Right. And, you know, when they started out, it was so much different, you know, they're going back before, you know, about the same time I was doing it, you know. So things have changed so much over the years, even with the special effects. And what you can do even today on your cell phone you couldn't do back on, you know, professional equipment back when I was doing it.
Well, I mean, if you, I don't know if it's time to get into the alien part of it yet, but if you lead the line of thinking, obviously not from just the Unsolved Mysteries episode, but, you know, if you follow, you know, UFO stories and what is, you know, a version of the truth or a story, you know, who knows, but, you know, a lot of the technological advances that we have in filmmaking might come from some sort of alien technology. You never know, you know?
Right. I mean, with the years I've been doing this, you know, and following UFOs, and I was really never into UFOs until like 1998, really. I mean, because I was had paranormal experiences with ghosts and spirits, but not, I didn't relate the two, you know. And what I've been finding out through all these different stories from a Project Blue Book, I mean, with that happened in my county, you know, and the experiences I know from that, and they all had the same similarity when I was watching the Berkshires, you know, that this craft didn't make any sound, you know. And after interviewing Tom Warner and Tom Reed and Melanie so far, you know, they were all gracious on giving me their time and their experience of that what happened, you know. And some of these relate back to earlier episodes I've done on past UFO activity. Did you feel anything like that could have happened? Or,
well, I mean, you know, certainly I go into this stuff with open eyes. I worked on a lot of ghost hunting stuff in the past before I really was even involved with UFO. I mean, I've been a fan of, you know, shows like Sightings. And
you just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Solve mysteries and a lot of these older haunted history shows, and then I got to work on some of the more recent stuff, like the stuff with the Ghost Adventures crew and this kind of stuff. You know, I went in with open eyes and hung out in like the 12 most haunted places in America. You know, I was open to those experiences, and I personally didn't feel anything. I tried, and, you know, I had an open mind to it. Not to say that there's nothing there, but I feel the same way about ghosts and aliens, that I don't not believe. So, you know, obviously, the possibility exists, and I'm open to it, but until I see concrete proof, I'm not fully going to believe in it. You know, it's more of, you know.
I think that's true with everybody, you know, unless you see it, unless something happens to you.
But I feel like, I mean, not just ghosts and aliens aside, there are a lot of people making blind decisions just on, dumb feelings or religion. If you had to say, do you believe in ghosts or aliens more? I would definitely say aliens, you know, I, especially working on Unsolved Mysteries and meeting some of these people and hearing their stories face to face and then having to recreate them. So I did all of the recreations of the stories. So I had to talk to some of these people to really, okay, when you came down from the craft, how did you come down, or what was the beam like, or what angle did it come in on? So I got to ask really technical questions of these people, and they could, you know, answer them as if it actually did happen to them, you know? So, I heard their stories and was there for some of the interviews and the pre-interviews and this kind of stuff. It definitely made me more of a believer, you know, being on the site of where these things actually happen. You know, there's actually a park up in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, where, and the bridge is still there, where Tom Reed has had his experience, you know, and it's also recognized as an actual event. You know, he's got accreditation that says that it is an off-world event actually happened here. And the Navy and the military are saying that there are these things that we don't know what they are. So it's, you know, again, if you follow, you know, the line of alien stuff, we could be leaning more towards disclosure, or it could be a distraction to just keep us, you know, our mind off of what else is going on.
What was your part in that episode?
Of the UFO episode?
Yes.
Well, I was the art director, so I handled all of the recreation. So with the producers and the lighting team and the camera team, you know, we worked to recreate their experiences as best as we could in a, you know, a way that's not showing anything too much, because we don't know what actually they saw, you know? So there was this line of showing, you know, what happened on the ground. You know, we had conversations about, you know, because there's more to those stories. And if you follow them up, I'm sure you have, and you've talked to them. Mm-hmm. All of those people have much more to those stories. But Unsolved Mysteries is a show that's kind of more based in reality. And the UFO stuff is a little bit more, obviously, out of this world. I mean, it's not that it's not based in reality, but it's definitely different than a murder or a missing person. I mean, sometimes the missing person is tied into the UFO abduction, like the case of Travis Walton, you know, and Fire in the Sky and that kind of stuff. But with the producer on Unsolved Mysteries, they wanted to lean towards what was the more believable part of the story. You know, obviously they talk about going up onto the crafts and stuff. And I was initially tasked with, we were going to be creating the interiors of these crafts and actually creating some beings and this kind of stuff. And that got all nixed pretty early on because it was started to go into the more unbelievable aspects of the story, which is obviously a part of it. You know, these people have stories that they were abducted and they did witness UFOs. But I think in the case of Unsolved Mysteries, they didn't get into what happened on the ship so much, or, you know, kept it in a way, all the stories kind of lined up in a way that if you watch it, you know, a lot of this, the Unsolved Mysteries episodes we did, and, you know, I think kind of just as a formula for them, it progresses from in the UFO story to what happened, people seeing it on the ground and seeing lights. And then it started getting to people who actually had the experiences of contact and being abducted and pulled up into the ships. And then it also had the experience of people who wanted to see it and had heard about it and were alive back then, but they didn't see anything, you know? So it's opening it up to all sides of the story, all sides of the spectrum, without casting doubt on any one of those people, you know?
And yeah,
I think that's why Unsolved Mysteries has been able to you know, cover a lot of these stories too, is because they show respect to the families and the people telling the stories. They're not saying any one side of the story is wrong. They're just presenting facts as they are told in the best and most honest way possible, I guess.
I think,
you know?
I think that's kind of shocked a lot of people, that episode being put in that 6-part series, you know, the UFO part, because it wasn't really, I don't know how to put it, like a Unsolved Mysteries type of true crime mystery.
Well, I mean, technically, I mean, it's not in that aspect, but if Unsolved Mysteries, if you go back to the older episodes, they had a lot of UFO stuff in there and some ghost stuff. They cut Unsolved in case of everything. They were across the board. It wasn't just like cops or you know, America's Most Wanted or something like that. This is, you know, weird stuff that happened. And, you know, I mean, in this first 6 episodes alone, get into the Freemasons, get into UFOs, get into, you know, stuff with, you know, the government. Actually, that's stuff that's actually in the next 6 episodes. Yeah, I worked on 4 episodes of this part, and I worked on 4 episodes of the next part. Some of the episodes were supposed to come out first, and you think got switched around, and that actually has something to do with, you know, evidence and you know, more of the story being coming out or being told. And that's also through the research of Unsolved Mysteries. Like, while we were doing these stories, you know, we got access to phone records and things that might have been locked before that opened evidence in cases. So some of these cases have a very good likelihood of being solved once they come out.
I'll be right back with the rest of my conversation with Doug Sackman.
Imagine going to a website or walking into a retail store and everything you see is only $1. Impossible, right? Well, you might think so, but Dollar Tree will prove you wrong. Dollar Tree is the nation's number one destination for value shopping. All of their stores are well-lit and crammed with all kinds of hidden treasures. Dollar Tree offers a plethora of merchandise that includes many national and regionally trusted brands. It doesn't matter if you're looking for housewares, dinnerware, candy, snacks, stationery, or holiday needs. You're going to find it at Dollar Tree. You can shop at your hometown store or shop online for exclusive offers, manufacture closeouts, watch videos, and join their Value Seekers Club. On top of all that, you can have your order shipped for free directly to your local store. To visit DollarTree.com, click on the link in the show notes to let them know we sent you. Doing so helps keep our podcast going. Dollar Tree, where everything is only $1.
I've had, you know, going on different sites like Facebook and Twitter and putting out there if anybody has any information on this. I was surprised. I got like so far like 7 emails already from people. They don't want to come on and talk. You know, they still don't want to give their name. It's their experience that happened that night on September 1st and also that summer that led up to that. You know, there's a lot of activity in that area. And I was surprised on the people that contacted me on their experiences. And some of them left messages at the police department that weren't recorded or, you know, put on record. They were basically called crazy. So, you know, they came for, you know, they come forward, and I imagine there's going to be more come forward since he's Tom Reed and Tom Warner and the others came forward with their stories, you know, so they might come forward with theirs.
Yeah. Well, that was the thing that actually held up, the first set of Unsolved Mysteries episode was supposed to come out earlier in the year, but they were still working out the system with Netflix on how they were going to handle all of the calls and things that were coming through the website, because things are different. Like back then, you know, the Unsolved Mysteries producers could field some of this evidence and be a little bit more involved with it. But now, you know, the way that the media is and the way that everything is, they have to pass this stuff off to the authorities as soon as possible if they get any solid leads. But they also can't be just passing off anyone that comes to them. So there is some kind of vetting that has to be done, the credibility of these stories and, you know, people just not coming in to sit, you know, say something because they heard it, you know, and they want to be a part of the story now, you know. So not to say, I think Unsolved Mysteries and the crew there have been doing it for so long, they know how to tell if someone, you know, they have steps that they take to make some of these stories more credible, you know.
Right. Are you surprised by the attention that this new series of Unsolved Mysteries is getting? I mean, it's what I hear is one of the most watched series on Netflix this summer.
Yeah, I mean, it's was number one the first few weeks that came out. I'm not sure where it is now, but it's definitely up there in the, you know, the most watched. I think, you know, Unsolved Mysteries is the original true crime show, you know, and there's so much, the world is just obsessed with true crime. There's like many podcast and you know, every network has their own version of a true crime show, and so of course when Unsolved Mysteries come back, everyone that's been following all this other true crime is going to jump onto that and want to check that out too. So I think that's a big part of the appeal. But then also they just did an amazing job with it, you know. They really you know, the entire team, a lot of people involved with the show. And I know for the UFO episode, it was 5 years of research to put together that particular story. You know, it might have been a broader thing of UFOs to begin with, or more about the, you know, the summer of that area, you know, but then they pinpointed these stories and these individuals with the, you know, the credibility and witnesses and people to back up and this kind of stuff to narrow it down to one specific day.
Right. After talking with Tom Reed, you know, he was telling me about the years he had into that, you know, before the episode. And I think they're all very excited about being part of it. But they all also shared the same, I don't say dislikes, you know, they didn't put everything in their, you know, part of their scene, or like, you know, the crew might've been at their house for 8 hours and they left a lot out that they thought could have been in. But with that being said, they know it, you know, sometimes it's all the hands of the director.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've actually have talked to some of the subjects after the fact, you know, after the show has come out, and, you know, they have expressed that to me. And I know they've, you know, probably expressed that to some of the producers as well. And it's something that, you know, every one of those people have a very long and intense story. And it's not just that night either, you know, so we can't put all of that stuff in. It's a documentary series, I guess, you know, so it's gotta be sort of fair and balanced and couldn't lean too towards one story or the other, you know. I think it was just, they're just trying to share the facts that tie all those stories together in a timeline that makes sense, you know. I mean, I know exactly what you mean, though. You know, I'm a part of films and TV shows and music videos, and there's tons of stuff that always gets left in the cutting room floor, you know.
Right. Mm-hmm.
One thing that Unsolved Mysteries did do, though, is they did release a bunch of stuff that did end up on the cutting room floor. If you go to just type Unsolved Mysteries additional evidence, it's a thing on Reddit that, you know, there's an Unsolved Mysteries thing on Reddit that you can put evidence, I think, and then there's a specific thread that has a Google document link that has scenes from every single one of the six episodes that were cut out for time, or it wasn't as relevant to the story as possible. Like for the UFO one, there's something about some cattle mutilations that we were actually going to be doing a reenactment for, and they ended up, you know, deciding they weren't going to use that part of it. So we didn't do the reenactment, but, you know, I had talked to the person about what they had found, and I was set to make some cows that were turned inside out, essentially made to look like bubblegum, you know, on all the blood was drained out of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the story is on the Google document in an edited version, but, you know, it's there, you know, it is the additional evidence. There's stuff for the, you know, the Ray Rivera case. And I mean, all of them, you know, there's additional stuff for, you know, and then there's also kind of the key points of evidence in each of the episodes or in those folders. So for the new term, I guess, armchair detectives, people at home who want to follow through, they, you know, it's kind of a crib sheet for, okay, these are all the things that were weird about what happened in these episodes. And these are all the points that there could have been a witness or someone could have more information. And then, you know, that's kind of where, you know, for people who are trying to solve this at home or might have more information, they can go on and say, hey, oh, I was involved with this or this, you know, this picture. I know this person or I know this car or whatever it is, you know?
Right. Well, Doug, I want to thank you for being on the show today and giving me some of your time. I know you're busy.
Yeah, my main website is just DougSackman.com, DougSackmann. I'm on Twitter and Facebook, Instagram, all under the same name. And you can see my most recent projects this week. I don't know when this is coming out, but Friday the 29th is the premiere of hashtag Shakespeare Shitstorm from the Troma team at Fantasia. And then I also have another movie I did special effects for called Goodbye Honey. Just really cool fire effects, you know, burning people and this kind of stuff. And that's at the Dances with Films LA Film Festival, which is also a virtual festival. So between 9:30 p.m. and 3:30 a.m., you have three or four chances to watch both of those movies, like live with audiences online, which I'm pretty interested to see. It's will be my first virtual festival experiences, I guess. So. And then one more, if I get one more plug in there, okay. The Honeymoon Phase, another movie I worked on, just came out on iTunes and Amazon Prime and all that kind of stuff. It's a psychological horror movie about the first 6 months of being married in a futuristic setting, I guess. The first 6 months of a relationship.
Thank you very much. I appreciate this.
All right. Thank you so much.
Today is part 5. Of my 8-part.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
A series on the Berkshires. I did want to focus on the cast and the crew from the people who brought this to TV. So here's my conversation with Justin Janowitz, director of photography for the Berkshires UFO. Welcome, Justin, to my show today. And I'm thrilled to have you on.
Thank you, Al. I appreciate you inviting me on.
So before we get started on the Berkshire episode, what led you to this line of work, you know, director of photography and films? And
oh, wow. That's the hour-long story to try to condense into 30 seconds, I think. I mean, I guess the easiest way to sort of say it is I've had a love for film since I was a kid. You know, I grew up in New Hampshire, and there was a little rental store, you know, back when we still had rental stores. I'd go there with my mom, you know, as many times a week as I could get her to take me, and always, you know, trying to find the new movies that were coming out. And my mom was a bit of a cinephile too, and she'd introduce me to films. You know, most kids aren't watching like Casablanca. just over the course of my childhood, just sort of fell more and more in love with cinema and filmmaking until I was accepted to Ithaca College. So I graduated from Ithaca College with a degree in cinema and photography. And then from there, I moved to LA, and I've been here for 17 years or so, working in the film business, not always as a cinematographer, but, you know, varying, very different jobs inside of the field.
So what would you say, is there a difference between a director of photography and cinematography?
I think different people have different responses. They're pretty universally interchangeable from everything that I've heard and everything that people have told me. And, you know, sometimes people separate it a little bit where, you know, a director of photography is someone that oversees multiple cameras or doesn't actually operate the camera themselves, whereas a cinematographer might be a one camera shoot that they operate. But at the same time, you know, Roger Deakins operates his own camera a lot of the time, and he's the director of photography. So, you know, I think it's pretty interchangeable terminology.
I was looking back on some of your history, and I really enjoyed your answer on what your core was on filmmaking. You know, just simplicity on is usually the best.
I've always sort of believed that filmmaking is about storytelling. That's why I got into it, is I love storytelling. And, you know, I think especially when it comes to the filming or, you know, the cinematography of whatever the project is, whether it's a documentary or a narrative or, I mean, even a music video, my goal is always to help tell the story as best as I possibly can and to help the director tell the story that they're trying to tell. And as soon as you get too many things in the way, too many toys that aren't necessary, too many lights, too many anything that distracts from the core of our job, which I do believe is storytelling, that it slows things down and things get in the way, and it becomes less about the story and more about, you know, just putting fancy things up on the screen. So I've always kind of gravitated towards that philosophy of, you know, simplest is usually best. You know, a lot of the people that I sort of look up to as cinematographers, you know, guys like Deakins and Conrad Hall, you know, they really sort of took the naturalistic approach a lot of the time to what they were shooting. And that's kind of how I've gravitated towards filming and what I like to do as part of the craft.
And I see the second part of that core filmmaking was the story always comes first, you know. So, you know, yeah, that would overtake the story with too much toys, you know, too much special effects, maybe, as you know, so to say.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, and maybe I'll get in trouble for saying this, but there was a film that I watched years ago. It's called There Be Dragons. Great film about the Spanish Revolution. It's beautiful. It is stunningly beautiful, and the things that they do with the camera and the lighting in that film are breathtaking. But the problem is, about halfway through, I started noticing that was distracting me from the story. And that's sort of when I really sort of came to that philosophy of, if anything is taking away from the story, then you need to get rid of it, because this is a storytelling medium. And when you distract from that or you take away from that, you're not doing justice to the story that you're trying to tell.
Yeah, and a third part of that core filmmaking was that the filmmaking is a team sport. So I did notice that the three episodes I watched on Unsolved with you and Marcus Clark, the director, Do you guys work as a team, or does he call you in for something? I mean, how does that work?
I've known Marcus for about a decade. We've been working together for a long time. We've been friends for a long time. So we're not a team that is hired together. You know, Marcus will be hired on a project as a director, and then if he feels that I'd be, you know, the best fit for the project for him as a cinematographer of that film or that project, then he calls me and he brings me in to shoot for him. You know, I've been fortunate. I love working with Marcus. I think he's a brilliant director, and he's a great collaborator. He really knows what he wants, but he's also open to hearing the thoughts of the people that he trusts that he surrounds himself with. So, you know, while we're not a quote unquote team or a package, we do work together a lot, and we have a lot of teammates sort of philosophy on a lot of stuff.
And how did you get the gig for Unsolved Mysteries?
It was Marcus. Marcus was hired to direct episodes of the show. From what I know, he told the production company that he wanted me to be his director of photography for his episodes, and they vetted me and they approved me, and then we were off to the races.
You know, that's one thing, after talking to Tom Reed, you know, Tom Warner and Melanie, that they all said the same thing. They thought he was so professional, and actually the whole team was so professional, and they loved their experience working with you guys.
Oh, that's really nice of them to say that. Thank you.
So, you know, after working with all three, was any one of them stand out more than another that you enjoyed working on? Or
I don't think that anyone stood out more than the other. I think that, you know, one thing that I find so interesting about this episode and just this whole, you know, UFO event of September 1st, 1969, is that, you know, I mean, everyone from Jane Green to Tom Warner, Tom Reed, Melanie Kirchdorfer, they all have their unique story of what happened to them. But there's so many similarities between their stories that that's what I sort of found the most interesting, I think, about just the overall project. You know, listening to how each of their individual stories really kind of stood out from the other ones, but also there was this air of similarity between them. So, you know, I mean, hearing Tom Reed talk about being in the car with his family, and then hearing Tom Warner talk about how the beam of light came on him and he was running in place. And I think they're all incredibly memorable stories, but, you know, I don't think that one necessarily stood out above and beyond the other ones.
Are you surprised on how this thing really took off? I mean, the Unsolved Mysteries on Netflix. I mean, it was the number one watched miniseries this past summer.
Yes and no. I mean, I grew up watching Unsolved Mysteries. You know, the original series, sort of the 80s and the 90s, and I was a huge fan of it. And it's been this sort of iconic property, you know, almost since its inception. You know, one of the first programs out there to really show mysteries that were unsolved. You know, a lot of the times, I think before that, there was an idea amongst TV makers that, you know, you have to have an end to the story in order for people to be interested in watching what you're watching. And Unsolved came out and put out all these episodes and all these stories of things that had not yet been solved. And then, you know, of course, asked the audience to help out. And over the years, there have been many, many cases that have been solved because of it being on the show, being featured, and then, you know, the audience tuning in. So when the reboot came along, you know, already I was a fan of the property and I knew how iconic the show was. And, you know, just sort of, you see these internet stories about the show's coming back, and the massive amount of people that were just so excited about it, that sort of gave me an inkling that the show was going to be really successful. And then having gone through it and know what we shot and, you know, knowing the people behind it that were going to put it together really well, I was hoping that it would be a nice, big, huge hit, but I don't think that I expected it to be as massively successful as it was.
You did what, work on three of them? I think it was Mystery on the Rooftop, No Ride Home, and the Berkshires UFO. You know, besides Berkshires, I mean, I enjoyed all of them, really, all six. I really enjoyed the No Ride Home. It just, you know, hasn't been solved. And I think that's my next question is, wouldn't it be great that what you're part of can actually solve one of these stories?
That would be the best thing that could possibly happen. You know, I mean, there's really not, I don't think, a whole lot to solve for the Berkshires UFO episode. You know, unless you know, the aliens are going to show up and say, yeah, we were there September 1st. You know, there's not much to do with that one. But both the Mystery on the Rooftop and the No Ride Home, the tragedies that befell these families. And, you know, you hear about these things, and just as a normal person, you say, well, I really hope that they can bring justice or they can find out what happened to that. But then you sit down with them and you meet the family and you sort of develop that personal connection over the days that you're with them. It would make me incredibly happy if they could get to the bottom of what happened, you know, especially the No Ride Home episode with Alonzo Brooks, you know, mm-hmm. His family. They deserve answers. Whoever did this, it really does need to be brought to justice.
We'll be right back with my conversation with Justin Janowitz after these messages.
This is Weird on the Rocks, a podcast that explores the weird, unusual, strange, and unexplained, all while getting our drink on. Join me every other Monday as I share a different cocktail and discuss true crime, paranormal stories, unexplained phenomena, conspiracy theories, and much more. Find Weird on the Rocks on social media, the website weirdontherocks.weebly.com, and listen on all of your favorite podcast apps. And don't forget to cheers and stay weird.
You know, when I was talking to Doug Sackman, who was the art director, he was telling me that there was a plan of actually putting a craft together where, like, they were inside the craft, and they nixed that idea early on.
Oh, I don't know about that. They might have discussed that and then decided to.
You don't have any say over what's put in the final episode?
No, my job is to shoot the episode, and you know, handle the lighting, the cameras, and run that entire department. So, you know, what we do shoot is based on, you know, what the director wants, what the production company wants, what, you know, what everyone thinks the story should be. And then, you know, I mean, as with everything that's shot, there are some things that end up on the cutting room floor. And, you know, I don't know who exactly it is that makes those final decisions, but I'm pretty out of the picture by the time that those decisions are made.
On the next six coming up on Unsolved, are you involved in any of those?
I am. I'm involved in a couple of those, but that's probably all that I can say about it.
Okay.
Before it premieres on October 19th.
You know, when I reached out to a lot of people when I was doing my research on this, everybody thinks of Robert Stack, you know, because what a great narrator he was, you know. So how's this going to work without somebody like him? And I thought the camera work was just phenomenal, you know, because you start out with Jane Green and it just takes you into the story. And I mean, the cast themselves, you know, they're basically the narrators, but I think the photography was phenomenal.
Thank you. I do. I really appreciate that. We put a lot of time and planning into trying to figure out how to, shoot the show in a familiar yet different way, if that makes any sense. You know, because of the fact that there is Robert Stack, who passed away years ago, and there wasn't going to be a narrator. And I think other people involved really wanted to try to make sure that, you know, the show felt familiar to the people who knew it, you know, back when it was playing in the 80s, 90s, I think even into the 2000s. But also make it feel updated a little bit and maybe a little more cinematic with new technologies that we have available to us. So I really hope that your audience members don't miss the narrator too much, but I think that the directors and the production company, they've done a really good job with telling the stories without really needing a narrator.
I was really surprised that, you know, came back on Netflix, you know, and not, you know, like NBC, ABC, CBS.
Yeah, I think so. You know, and again, I can't speak too much to that just because, you know, as I'm not a creator, I'm not a director, but, you know, I do know that Netflix really prides himself on being open to the creative process and to the creators, you know, and I do think that you have probably a little more freedom on a platform like Netflix than you would on your typical kind of broadcast, you know, ABC, CBS kind of station, you know?
Right. When I was doing my research and putting this out to my fellow podcasters that I'm friends with, I have friends in Australia and England, sending me their response, you know, so, you know, it really hits home when you find out, you know, people, you know, they're watching it that far away, Japan.
Yeah. It's crazy. I had put something up on, I think one of my social media accounts when the show had been, you know, the number one program on Netflix in the US for, you know, 5, 6, 7 days, something like that. And, a friend of mine in England took a screenshot and he said, it's number one here too. And he sent it to me and I was like, wow, this is number one. I mean, I can't say across the globe, but it's the amount of people that were tuning in to watch these episodes is really just spectacular.
You know, another thing too, and I put this out there, you know, on Facebook groups and Twitter and Instagrams, I was looking for people that knew anybody maybe back then that seen this or was involved in this any way. And I was really surprised. I got like responses back from people. You know, this happened on the same night, but wasn't in Berkshire, was like in Connecticut, and one was in New York. And they didn't want to give their name, but they just wanted to share their experience, you know, and how they did. One of them told me they did call it in, you know, and they were told basically, you know, what were you drinking tonight? You know, so, you know, so I think maybe with these people coming forward and sharing their story, maybe more will come forward that maybe were afraid to speak out all these years.
I hope so too. You know, one thing that's also been interesting is, you know, while we were there actually physically filming the episode, it just so happened that the New York Times put out that article where it said that
you just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
The Navy pilots had seen this unexplained object. And the video was released, and it's while we were in the middle of shooting this episode, which is kind of crazy timing. And then since then, I think it was July of this year, the New York Times did another article where they talked about the Pentagon saying that, you know, they said they dismantled all these UFO programs, but they were still happening. And there are people who are studying, I think the quote was, you know, either vehicles or objects not from this Earth. And, you know, the fact that all these little things kind of keep coming out, I hope that gives the other people that may have experienced something a little more, maybe a little more freedom to come out and share their experiences. And I think the more people that you get sharing what happened to them or what they experienced that night or other nights just provides more information and tries to help us get to the bottom of what this actually is.
I'll be right back with the conclusion after this short message.
Hello, I'm Kayla Knight, the host of Get Grim, a weekly podcast for the miniature folklorist or teller of tales in your life. Each week, I adventure to adapt several tales around a central theme and share them with my audience, along with my own commentary and background on each story. New episodes are released every Saturday, and I can be found on Apple iTunes or on your favorite podcast app.
In 1994, we had an incident in our county, in Trumbull County, Ohio, with UFOs, and it made the Art Bell Show. You know, with that show and also what happened in the county over from mine in 1966, matter of fact, that story went on to create Close Encounters of the Third Kind. With all these stories and with yours on the Berkshires, one thing they all had in common was the craft didn't make any noise. What Melanie was telling me, you know, when you're on that craft, you know, there's no sound. And Tom Warner.
It's amazing. Their stories of what they experienced.
These things, and this is, you can look it up on YouTube, UFOs over Trumbull County. And I know a couple of the police officers at that time, personally, a light shined down on them, no sound, but they had that knocked out their power, their cruiser, no radio signal. And I just thought it was amazing that there's so many similarities in the Portage County incident, the Trumbull County incident, the Berkshires. Did my research on it, and all of a sudden all these people contacted me, you know, how your shows affect people around the world.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I think that kind of harkens back a little bit to one of the reasons that I fell in love with filmmaking is that it is this storytelling medium that, you know, it touches on almost all your senses. You know, of course, obviously not smell, but, you know, you get the sound, you get the picture, you get, you know, the use of music and the use of camera angles and all that comes together to really impact the audience's viewing experience, you know, or their experience of being told the story. And that's why it's my favorite storytelling medium. That's why I chose to go into this. Just the ability to touch people and either inform or offer them experiences that they may never have another way of seeing or being a part of. It's almost magical.
Well, Justin, I really enjoyed talking to you. What do you have planned for the future?
Well, I have a documentary that I shot that I believe is coming out sometime next year. Other than that, I mean, honestly, this whole COVID thing has really kind of put a damper on our industry. There's not a whole lot happening right now. So I've kind of taken this time to develop some projects, both narrative and in the docu world that I'd like to investigate a little bit more myself and putting those together and trying to make those happen. So, you know, trying to take the downtime to turn it into a positive and keep everything moving forward.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time. I really do appreciate that.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Justin. I want to thank Justin Janowitz for being my guest today. It was my pleasure to have Justin sharing his experience and knowledge and creativity on his process of filmmaking. I really did enjoy his core of filmmaking, which is a three-part process, really. It's boils down to simplicity. The story always comes first. It's a team sport. Be sure to come back next week when I will be talking to Marcus Clark, the director of the Berkshire UFOs. And also make sure you go to Apple Podcast, rate, review, and subscribe to Ghosts in the Valley. Mystery on the Rooftop. No Ride Home. Berkshire's UFO. All three of these episodes were recently released through Netflix
on the new Unsolved Mysteries that was put out this past summer. Marcus A. Clarke was the director of these three episodes. I am thrilled that he agreed to be on the show today and go into his background and how he got into filmmaking, and maybe filmmaking wasn't his number one passion when he was growing up, or was it? We're going to get into all of that and much more. So from the young boy that grew up and was born in Brooklyn, New York, and had worked with Spike Lee and his team in many, many other projects, I am your host, Al Cooley, host of Ghosts in the Valley. And here is my exclusive interview with Marcus A. Clarke. Hello, Marcus, and thank you for joining me on Ghost in the Valley's Berkshire's UFO. And I'm excited that you got back to me and to share your experiences on working on this episode.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on the podcast. I really appreciate it. I'm looking forward to talking about the show and bringing back Unsolved Mysteries.
I see that you're a director, producer, filmmaker. Which one do you like the best? I mean, directing?
Yeah, directing is definitely what I like the best. It's where my passion is. It's what I enjoy the most. But all, you know, on the path to directing, I was a producer first. And so I got a lot of experience from producing for different directors and different genres, whether that's commercials or, you know, fashion or documentaries. You know, a lot of producing goes in there. And then the filmmaker, you know, for me, just as a distinction, you know, a filmmaker is a little different than both. A filmmaker can take an idea from, you know, from the conception, from the ideation, and then, you know, take it all the way through the process of creating it through post, through the edit, and delivering it. So the filmmaker term is a little bit more all-inclusive of somebody who can create films and kind of any type of content. But directing is really my passion, and that's really what I'm focused on most right now.
I see you have some experience working with Spike Lee. That ought to be exciting.
That's right. Yeah, definitely. It was a lot younger then in my younger years. But, you know, I did start out being a gopher for Spike Lee. So I would actually fly to Spike where he was shooting, wherever he was filming, pick up the film, because at that time they actually did still shoot film. And then I would have to fly it back to New York and get it to the processing center. So, you know, sometimes that was international. So I'd deal with customs and that kind of thing. But it was, you know, at the time I was a production assistant, pretty low on the level of production there, but it was very exciting times because, you know, here I am, you know, 17, 18 year old kid, traveling around, picking up Spike Lee's footage and dropping it off. So it was an important experience in my life.
Right. And working with like, assistant director, Mike Ellis. I mean, you have to, I mean, that's gotta be great to learn from people like that.
Yeah. Yeah, man. When I first linked up with Spike, you know, it should be noted that, you know, I started in commercials first when I was 16 years old. I was very fortunate to get an opportunity at a young age for a commercial company that did, you know, everything from Tropicana commercials to Long John Silver's and Pizza Hut. So at a very, very young age, I was kind of indoctrinated on set in terms of, you know, how film practices go, how to manage a film set and in that environment. So by the time I got to Spike's set, which was probably about 6 years, you know, into my production experience, at that time, I wanted to be a first assistant director. And Mike Ellis is, you know, a legendary first assistant director for Spike Lee, for music videos, for films. And he was really a glaring example of what an incredible first assistant director was. And so I took to him, and that was kind of where I learned a lot of the AD skills in terms of how to run a set, schedule an actual shoot, and just how to, you know, wield the command of the actual set and the different departments. So that was really impactful. And then the closer I got to the assistant director role, you know, the more I could pick up little things here and there from Spike. And so that was a really important kind of time in my development.
So I figure, you know, running for like Spike Lee, you had to really, you know, get your feet wet and, you know, and teaches you a lot on maybe on ideas that you have, you know, in different ways you can approach it.
Yeah, of course. It was, you know, it was a fortunate learning experience. And like, you know, Spike is a very specific director compared to a lot of other directors. He's very specific. He's very strict, you could say, in terms of what the expectations are from the crew. And so being around that environment, it's also like a family. You know, the people who work with him kind of always work with him on different projects. You see a lot of the same faces on set. So it becomes very familiar. But just getting that experience and being able to see him work and be close enough to overhear some conversations and just, you know, take all of that inspiration into what I wanted to do
you know, had a really big impact, you know, on my creativity, on what I wanted to do and what I thought was possible. So yeah, it was a very, very impactful experience working with Spike. Even if I was just gophering and delivering, you know, footage or being a production assistant at that time, it was, you know, that was everything for me. I was wide-eyed and, you know, curious and interested and kind of just absorbing everything I could.
Looking at your bio, you had, what, over 20 years of experience in commercial production.
That's right. Yeah. You know, because I started so young, you know, I got my start in the business at 16. You know, I was still in high school, technically. And as an intern, a production assistant, I worked for the same company for about 7 years. So, you know, if I went away to school and I'd come back, I'd be working at this commercial production company. So, you know, I had a lot of experience, advanced experience, because the company I was working for, they shot really big budget commercials, like big Lifesavers commercials. And when they used to shoot all commercials practically, so like there was no CGI, there was models and recreations of Doritos chips and chocolate bars and wafers that we would throw into tanks of milk. And, you know, it was very high end production. So, you know, I was very, very lucky to see all that and to just kind of be a fly on the wall while director Santiago Suarez would do his thing. And so it was, you know, I was able to absorb all that very young. So that gave me an edge, I would say, in the business.
Yeah, I want to thank you for sending me over to Justin Chenoweth. It was really enlightening talking to him. I was looking at his three points of view of looking at the core of filmmaking. You know, number one being simplicity, like, you know, simple is the best. And number two is story comes first. And three was filmmaking is a team effort, so to say.
That's right. Yep. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a huge collaborative effort. I mean, filmmaking is an extremely difficult process. If you're talking long form, whether it's a series or an actual documentary feature, you know, it's really, you need a lot of people. You need a lot of different departments. You need a lot of, you know, people who have special skills in different departments. And, you know, I always like to say, you know, director is only as good as his crew. That's very true. You know, it's like, yes, the director gets a lot of the credit and gets the name and this and that. But every time you see a director succeed, it's because of their team. You know, it's because of the crew that's behind them. It's because of the professionals they work with. And similarly, you know, and you know, Elon Musk has said this, but similarly, if a director fails, that's all on the director. You know, it's like a flip of the kind of paradigm, like the responsibility, and all comes down to you. So if you fail and the project isn't what it's supposed to be, or, you know, isn't winning, so to speak, it does kind of all come down on the director. But the win has to be shared, you know, definitely with the team, because that's the only way to really get there and to get the kind of excellence that you need to make really good quality content.
I see you, when you were growing up, you're born in Brooklyn, New York.
That's right. Born and raised.
Born and raised in Brooklyn. When you were in school as a youngster, you know, when the teachers ask you, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? Was your thought ever to become a director, producer, filmmaker?
You know, what's funny. I wanted to be a director and a filmmaker, but at that time, you know, let's say between, you know, anywhere between 16 and 20, let's say, or 21, I actually wanted to go into computer science, strangely enough. I was still doing all the film work, but I had spent a good amount of time like learning website design and HTML protocol and Flash animations. And I was working on like a very technical side of kind of what my interests were, very into technology and like future things. So I was very kind of going in that direction. And then oddly enough, I went to college in Middlebury, Vermont. And during that time, my major was actually computer science. And because I had started computer science in high school, I already had some skills. So, you know, I came into a 101 class that was probably like, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning, you know, my first year of college. And I'm basically sleeping through every class, to be honest with you, because it's 101. Came down to my midterm and I do like a, you know, a big website and Flash and there's animations and there's fade. There's all this kind of stuff happening. And my professor didn't believe that I had done the site. Actually thought it was plagiarism, had put me up against the school, basically saying that there's no way I could have known how to design a site like this. They didn't teach it. It was too advanced. They thought I cheated. Long story short, I ended up out of that experience, which I didn't really like. I changed my major to film, and that was kind of all she wrote. So like I was going in a very different trajectory my first year in college. And then after that experience, and don't get me wrong, I love the school I went to. I love Middlebury College. I had an incredible experience there. But this freshman year thing that happened really just put a bad taste in my mouth in terms of pursuing computer science. So I stepped away from that and I went full throttle with the film stuff.
Isn't it funny how life comes at you? You never think what's going to happen. You think you're going to be a doctor?
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
And then next thing you know, you're a hairdresser, you know. That might not be a very good terminology, but you know what I'm saying.
No, but 100%, 100%. You just never know. You never know. And you know, it's not all glory. There was a time when, you know, I was still, you know, struggling to make the next rounds up, like, you know, elevate in the business. I did a couple years, I did about 5 years or so working for Victoria's Secret. And I was doing a lot of cool, like, behind the scenes Victoria's Secret shoots and, you know, online fashion shoots. And I was there with all the models and all the big shoot. I was like part of it. And at one point, a sound guy, I told my friend, the sound guy, Richard, I told him the story that I just told you, you know, that I was focusing on computer science and I wanted to be a web designer. And then, you know, this thing happened and my parents screamed racism. And then I was like, I can't do computer science anymore. And I went back to film. And he looked at me and he said, and this is when I'm a production assistant for Victoria's Secret. And he's like, can you imagine where you would have been if you just stayed with computer science?
Right.
You could be at Google. You could be at Apple. And I'm like, at that time, I'm a young kid. I'm a young man. And I'm working for Victoria's Secret. I'm like, I'm at Victoria's Secret. I'm fine. I'm happy right here. I mean, I'll carry the cases, but I'm happy right here. But it just goes to show you, you never know how things are going to pan out.
I see you also work for CNN.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So the first big feature documentary I did was what I produced was Fresh Dress. And that was a CNN film, you know, funded by CNN when the CNN Films division kind of had just kicked off. They did a bunch of really important films. Fresh Dress was one of them. I did that with a company called Mass Appeal. The director was Sasha Jenkins, really incredible director. A man I produced for, you know, a while in the past for Mass Appeal, incredibly talented director. And, you know, we did Fresh Dress and we took it to Sundance and you got an incredible, you know, reception at the premiere of Sundance. And it was really an incredible experience. And that really explores the history of urban fashion, hip hop fashion, as you could say, you know, from the late 70s, early 80s, you know, to 2012 or 2014 when we did it. So, you know, really kind of a history lesson on the history of hip hop fashion and how a lot of those brands got kind of absorbed into higher fashion brands, legacy brands, kind of in their rise and in their decline.
This latest release on Netflix with the Unsolved Mysteries, this isn't your first rodeo with Netflix.
That's right. It isn't. You know, I've been doing a lot of work for Netflix over the past few years. You know, they're an incredible partner. They're an incredible client. I love working with them. There's a certain amount of creative freedom and creative liberty that Netflix allows, which virtually does not exist within the rest of kind of long form and streaming kind of platforms in terms of how much they allow the creativity to drive, you know, the content that you're making. And so, you know, Fresh Dress, strangely enough, before Netflix Originals, you know, took over the world, Fresh Dressed was one of the films that they had licensed, you know, back when it had come out. At that time, Netflix was licensing a lot of films and documentaries that were made already. Fresh Dress was one of those early on. After the success of Fresh Dress, Mass Appeal got a deal to do Rapture, which was an 8-part hip-hop series, an immersive, highly immersive hip-hop series, each episode driven on a different artist and addressing, you know, a different factor or component of the larger kind of hip-hop world, hip-hop culture. I mean, so it's a deep dive into these celebrities' lives, what the reality is of being a celebrity. And that was a Netflix original series that we did. I did 3 of those episodes and it did really well.
Now, did that lead you into the new Unsolved Mysteries?
It did to some degree, but there's a small actual lapse of time in between Rapture and Unsolved Mysteries. I did another series, believe it or not, for Netflix that hasn't aired or come out yet, but I had done another series in between and that series really helped kind of catapult me towards Unsolved Mysteries. along with the documentary I did with Future, entitled The Wizard on Apple Music. You know, that's another kind of hip hop documentary, but it's about a real kind of like a superstar of hip hop and like watching his rise, documenting his rise. And in that, because the star himself, Future, is so mysterious and elusive, and he has a brand mystery kind of around him, I put a lot of those themes into his film and into his documentary. Because I think, you know, in these days, in the present, with so much documentary content and so much, you know, competition, so to speak, you know, infusing narrative themes into these documentaries, whether it's suspense, mystery, intrigue, making sure there's an arc, like all of these themes that are kind of narrative at their heart, you know, are being infused into the documentary world. So I did that with Future. And I think that caught a lot of attention in terms of how can we create more mystery, more suspense, you know, with this type of director, applying that kind of creative ethos to Unsolved Mysteries on the brand.
You had mentioned that you had probably a little more creativity or freedom, I should say, with Netflix than say you would with ABC, NBC.
Absolutely.
I noticed that in a couple of the episodes on Unsolved, was, you know, you would never hear that type of language or even say commercial breaks, you know. So
right.
I think it really, I mean, I told Justin this, you know, I thought it was phenomenal. I really did. I really thought the camera Thank work you. And everything was just, because really you have to tell the story with the camera and the people in that story, because you don't have anybody like Robert Stack doing that for you now.
That's right. That's right. So the storytelling and the conventions that we use, you know, have to be, you know, there's twofold. It has to be way more immersive, number one, which it kind of is by virtue of, like you said, no commercials and no host. And you're really, it's really character driven. It's really about the subjects. It's really about their emotions. But you have to have a lot of, you know, you have to be able to build in enough context. You have to be able to build in enough of the actual information and the clues and the what do we know about the situation. So there's a lot of that to work into it. But then again, you know, the visuals have to be compelling. And like I'm saying, with like a lot of competition and a lot of, you know, true crime mystery shows are hot right now. You know, this is, you're talking about like one of the hottest genres in streaming. And so how you approach recreations and how you approach the visual aesthetic really has to be dialed in if you want to stand out. So there's a lot of things we will do and won't do, you know, pertaining to the series, that really becomes the you know, the brand, so to speak, the identifier of the show. Because you're telling a story with the camera, but you're also not trying to show anything that is too vivid or too, like, you know, you don't want to handhold the audience. You want to allow them to kind of break down the visuals that's happening, you know, as they unfold to understand what the story is.
You must have did a great job, because it's it's a number one watched miniseries on Netflix this summer.
That's right. That's right. Number one, and number one globally for a good amount of time, which is, you know, beyond everyone's wildest expectations. So very, very happy to hear that.
I reached out to a few of my podcaster friends, and, you know, for my final episode, I'm just going to be like a round table with friends of mine in the paranormal field, and their comments on the series or on the show, Berkshire's UFO. Mm-hmm. And it really hit me when I have a friend of mine in England texting me saying, you know, wow, it was a powerful series, you know, mm-hmm, and, mm-hmm. you know, and somebody from Japan, you know, texting me the same thing. So, you know, it really hits home when, you know, people that around the world are watching this, you know, how right. it affects them.
Yeah, no, it's incredible. And, you know, here's what I'll say, like Unsolved Mysteries as a brand, as a show from its inception is kind of ahead of it, way ahead of its time in terms of, you know, the call to action, having the audience engaged and calling in with tips. You know, the original show didn't have the internet as a backbone. And so now in this world that we live in, you know, the show coupled with the internet is just a really wildly, you know, compelling, but also just, it's more effective because people can communicate, people can share information like you're describing, people from Japan or from England or from Australia, wherever, people are all sharing information and seeing this stuff. And it creates a conversation, whereas in the past it did the same thing, but it was a much slower burn, much slower results, much slower coverage from the press. And now with the Netflix platform, the reach is just so extensive. You know, Netflix is in 190 countries, and so they're everywhere.
Right. Before, you had to watch it on the, like, say, you know, ABC or whatever, and it was on the one time. Then if you want to watch it again, you had to wait for the rerun.
That's right.
And now you can stream it on your iPhone or your iPad or any device really, and whenever you want.
And most importantly, you can press pause and then rewind. Like, that's simple now, but you couldn't do that before. Like, you had to catch it in the moment. You had to be sitting down on your couch at that half hour, at that hour. Like, that was it. Now you can pick it up and watch it whenever you want. You can stop, you can rewind, you can look back at the details, look back at the clues. Oh, what did they say about this? And rewind straight to it. So, like, the paradigm has shifted. And so I think that's a good part of why it's, you know, why it's so successful. And then, you know, people like myself, like, I watched the show growing up. I grew up watching the show, you know, with my parents late at night when I shouldn't have been, you know, so I was also very familiar with the style, with how it makes you feel, with the aesthetic, with the whole, you know, with the whole vibe. So I was really put in a super fortunate position to be able to help bring the show back, because not only am I making content for right now, which is kind of, you know, I would say, you know, respectfully on the, you know, on the cutting edge of documentary filmmaking, but I have this memory of the show. So it was much easier for me to kind of visualize and pair, what does this show look like in 2020? You know, what is Unsolved Mysteries in 2020? Because the line, what people don't understand is the line between something being spooky, scary, and enthralling, and something being corny and unbelievable and, like, bad, essentially, is very thin, especially in 2020. You can't do these cheesy recreations. Everything has to be a whole different style of how you're approaching it, you know? There's a higher bar.
Three episodes you worked on The Unsolved was Mystery on the Rooftop, No Ride Home, and The Berkshires UFO. Naturally, my thing's on The Berkshires. But my sister and I, we were just talking last night, and she just totally loved the No Ride Home, because it, like, really hit home. Like, you know, I mean, somebody out there knows something about this.
Absolutely.
I think, like I was telling Justin, I mean, it has to be the icing on a cake is when one of these cases are solved, you know, and you're part of that.
100%. 100%. I mean, that is the, you know, that's the goal. That's the, you know, I don't want to say the dream, but it's kind of the dream. Like, we, you know, making documentaries that affect change is always kind of the cornerstone, and, like, you know, that gets awareness to certain things. But this show and, the, you know, this style interacts with reality, with real reality, in a way that is just different and way more powerful. So, you know, next to America's Most Wanted, Unsolved Mysteries has the highest rate of cases actually being solved. The actual statistic escapes me right now, but I think it's like 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 have gotten solved in the course of the show's, you know, tenure. So yeah, I mean, that is a dream to be able to affect change, but it's like, this story, the Alonzo story, No Ride Home, was way more personal for me for a lot of very obvious reasons. You know, I'm an African-American, you know, I've obviously grown up in this country and dealt with what I've dealt with. So, you know, like I mentioned, I was fortunate enough to get a very crazy opportunity at a very young age, which has made the difference in my life. And so if I can take those skills and the things that I've learned and apply them in a way that's going to help people who are also, you know, who have gone through a similar experience or have gone through a, you know, a worse experience, you know, I feel in some ways, many ways, obligated and compelled, obviously, to do those things. And so the Alonzo episode was really very difficult for me. It was very challenging emotionally. It was very challenging being there, physically being in this area of Kansas. And so there's a lot of that energy I tried to put into it, to put directly into that film. So if something does come out of it, if some justice comes out of it, I know the case is reopened by the FBI. You know, that's all we can hope for and dream for. That would be the highest kind of goal and achievement of the show, and the family deserves it. You know, it's bigger than just entertainment at that point.
I'll be right back with the conclusion of my interview with Marcus A. Clark after these brief messages.
Hello, this is Cindy Martinez, the host of Welcome to the Neighborhood podcast. Ever since I was young, I've had a passion for true crime and the paranormal. This podcast focuses on cases and stories from different cities while making the Chicagoland, my hometown, our base. If you find yourself intrigued by crime and all things spooky, find us on Apple, Spotify, and Google. We post new episodes every Friday. Be sure to stop by.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, you have to get, I mean, really connected with the family and, you know, pull your strings that way. you know, as you're on your way home on the plane or whatever, you know, you have to be thinking about, you know, that mother, what she's going through, you know. And, you know, they're out there, what, four to six hours, and they find his body, you know, in the FBI and the police. And I don't know if you filmed that or if maybe I missed it, but the shed, you know, where she had mentioned it's no longer there, but maybe his body might have been in there. Nobody checked the shed.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, you know, what's crazy about what you just, you know, the shed moment, right? And I think I can share this, but while we were there, they pointed out that there was this, you know, shed missing, that he could have been in the shed. We filmed where the shed was. And the only reason, and this is the most bizarre, you know, I'm sure your listeners will enjoy this because of the paranormal aspect. They pointed to the area where the shed was. And based on the time of day that we were there shooting, the sun created almost a shadow, an imprint, if you will, into the tree line of where the shed was. And so,
wow.
Almost like...
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
If you're a kid looking at a coloring book or something, you could see an indentation in the tree line of exactly where the shed was, like a perfect triangular box imprint where the tree growth had grown around the shed. And now the shed's not there. So you could essentially just, you know, draw in where the shed was. We filmed that actual scene. Unfortunately, it didn't make it into the final cut, which I think it would have been really important just to see how creepy this area of the tree line was where the shed was. And the bizarre thing about that is, you know, I asked Justin, I said, you know, if you can film it, let's film it. Let's get it on camera. He gets it on camera. Later in the day, you know, 5 hours later, we're still in the same location filming. But the sun has moved into a different position in the sky, and now we cannot see where the indentation was. And so for that moment, for that brief, you know, 20 minutes, 30 minutes or so, where the location of the shed was visible for that time because of where the sun was.
Maybe Alonzo was giving you a message, you know. You know, look here, you know.
Let me tell you, man, there was, you know, and I don't want to go too far off the deep end, but there were numerous, multiple times in which something like this occurred that was very bizarre, that felt like we were being nudged to look in a certain direction or to look at things and to pay attention to certain things. There was a lot of different, very peculiar things that happened in that creek and around that area on those grounds that I have trouble explaining. And that's one of them. And the only reason that one is so particularly crazy is because we did actually film where the shed was. And it was in a bizarre area. And, you know, you start to then ask yourself questions like, well, this whole area is farmland, raw farmland. Why would you remove a shed? Why would you burn a shed down or remove it or whatever you did? There's sheds all over the place. This is empty acres of land. Where did the shed go?
Yeah, his DNA is probably in that shed. You know what I'm saying?
That's correct. I would imagine so.
My sister's going to be happy because she has African-American children, you know, and, mm-hmm. you know, and it does hit home. Like if, you know, like her grandson, you know, it could have been her grandson. It could have been anybody's, you know, and with the racism and everything that goes on and even to this day, you know, and maybe they wouldn't, they pursued it at a different rate than they would say, I hate to say it, but, you know, like a white kid.
Of course.
You know, course. But I thought you did a really good job on that. And that was one of probably, I like that one as much as the Berkshires, you know. Of course, they were all good, you know. But getting to the Berkshires,
yeah,
I must say, since I interviewed almost everybody, Tom Reed, Tom Warner, Melanie, But they all, even a few of the crew I've talked to, mm-hmm. I must say they all loved working with you. That's, I thought you were very professional.
Oh, thank you.
And they just enjoyed their time with you and sharing their story. They said they didn't feel like they were a kook or anything. You know, you looked at it the way they looked, the way they seen it in 1969.
That's right. That's right. I mean, you know, I really enjoyed my time, you know, speaking to all of them and making this film in particular. You know, like I said, the Alonzo thing was very personal to me for obvious reasons, but the UFO thing, you know, has been an interest of mine. The UFO topic has been an interest of mine forever, since I was a kid, you know, to now, to the present. Like, I've always been interested in this topic and this content, and I've always been bothered by, you know, the kooky aspect of how many filmmakers, approach this subject, where it's not taken seriously. There's almost this edge of trying to get the audience to laugh or to think that they're quirky or funny or weird or out there. And it really defeats and deflates kind of the purpose and the authenticity. You know, my job is to come in there, especially with an episode like this, and to see what they saw and to visualize what that experience was like. And to try to get out as much information and details around what they can remember as possible. Now, in that process, there might be some, you know, I'm keeping record of all the things I'm asking, all the questions and the details. So as I go from one person to the next, I might be looking for some discrepancies or, you know, a difference of opinion or something. But ultimately, I'm not there to question whether or not these people are out of their minds or not. You know, you have, unless I'm given some kind of reason to think otherwise, everyone is an upstanding, you know, moral person that is telling me the truth. You know what I mean? And I'm there, we vet these people, and I'm there to kind of facilitate what that truth is. And what, you know, weed through the details on what happened. So, you know, I had a lot of respect for them, and I respect that they came forward to share their stories, which made it, you know, which made the show what it is. But it's those kind of people who need to be brave and have to come forward with an issue that they've been criticized for, you know, for years because of the history of how the subject is treated. You know, people are ostracized. People are called crazy. People don't want to share their stories. Other people make fun of them. And so part of this was to, you know, approach this like I would approach any other documentary and not judge the subject matter before making the film.
When I reached out to get some comments on this on, you know, into different Facebook groups and Twitter and Instagram. And I was amazed. I got a few stories back from people at that time around different areas of the Berkshires who actually seen the UFO that night. Mm-hmm. One even told me they called it in and was told, like, portrayed like they were crazy, you know, so they didn't even pursue it after that, you know. And another person told me he was under the light. He wasn't abducted, mm-hmm. but he was under the light of the UFO. Mm-hmm. And at that time, he was 27 years old. But he always had a problem and then was hospitalized because of his migraine headaches. But since that night, he's never had another migraine headache.
Oh, wow.
You know, and, you know, stories like that, you know, and that you know, naturally didn't come forward or wasn't on Netflix, you know, but I was amazed on the amount of people that contacted me that has, you know, whether it be in New York or Connecticut, Massachusetts, you know, they had a story to share.
Right. Right. I think times are changing when it comes to people sharing their story. I mean, one, because, you know, you see, you have outlets like this, you know, Netflix that are kind of, you know, putting the subject matter forward and making, normalizing it in a way. But then also, and we talk about this in the episode, but, you know, the New York Times, the government, you know, has basically admitted that UFOs exist. So, like, kind of the biggest announcement, the biggest awakening moment in human history in many ways has already taken place. And people aren't really paying attention. There's a lot of other things going on in the world, so that makes sense why everybody's not paying attention. But, you know, the Navy has released videos, actual video from fighter jets of UFOs in action. And so they've come forward and said, these things exist. And so more people who have felt like don't want to share their story or don't want to talk about it are probably feeling more comfortable now to talk about it because there's some acknowledgement that this phenomenon is real. And so I think, you know, I honestly think that the trauma of not being believed and the trauma of how the subject matter has been treated has, you know, discouraged people from ever coming forward to talk about it. But I think those times are changing now.
Oh, I think so. You know, it's like I was telling Justin, you know, I had a conversation with a fighter pilot from the Navy who, as he put it, was in a dogfight with one, you know, over Skinwalker Ridge. Mm-hmm. And it was amazing because I look at his story. I look at the stories that happened in my county back in 1994 with UFOs over Trumbull County. So I look at all these incidences, you know, and how they all have one similarity, that that craft didn't make any noise.
That's right.
You know, and like the pilot was telling me, you know, it's when he's estimating around 6,000 miles an hour. And he says, I'm probably being too lenient with that number. But he says, but it's amazing that, you know, what he's told to put out there or what he can't even put out there, mm-hmm. you know, because of national security and whatnot.
Right, right. Yeah, and, you know, while we're doing the show, when I'm interviewing, like I said, there's a lot of questions I'm asking about details and other things I'm kind of cross-referencing with other guests as we're going through the process. And, you know, to me, there's a bunch of details that are not shared in the show that they all kind of discuss and describe and talk about. And because everybody who's, you know, in our episode, you know, all of those people didn't necessarily, they weren't all friends all these years. They weren't all kind of, you know, they don't even all necessarily get along, put it that way. And so in talking to all of them, I'm pulling out truths they don't all necessarily, but they haven't spoken about. And so one of those was, you know, describing a color that they've never seen before. This was a theme everybody who saw the craft described. And that is a really hard thing to imagine, which is what, you know, what is a color I've never seen before? And so they describe this vibrant color that's kind of changing, but they've never seen it. They also describe the lights on the craft being extremely bright. However, like Jane Green, for instance, it's bright, but as she's close to it, the light isn't actually affecting her eyes at all. She's not squinting. She doesn't put up a hand over her face because she can't see. Tom Warner described the same thing. They're looking directly into this bright, you know, quote unquote, blinding light, but it's not actually affecting. They can see clearly. And so that's a very specific phenomenon that everyone kind of describes, which to me adds a lot more credibility to their stories. These are the kind of questions that come out, you know, an hour into the interview when I'm asking very minutia, you know, about what they saw. And so that kind of that thread, that similarity through all the stories, to me adds a lot of credibility to the overall phenomenon.
Yeah, they all enjoyed their storytelling, and I think they all also agreed that there was parts that were not put in there that they wish were put in there, including my conversation with Judge Titus. You know,
yeah,
but
yes.
I do know that, you know, a lot of things are out of your hand. You know, you do the filmmaking and somebody else does the cutting, so to speak, you know, what's put in, what's left out, and how you, I just thought the way the thing even opened up with Jane pointing across where to, you know, just taking you on that journey, mm-hmm. you know, and it just drew you in right off the bat.
Right. Thank you for that. I mean, that's another, you know, that again, that was another, I don't want to say technique, but that was another kind of, you know, style to bring people in immediately from the get-go, and to also ground the episode around who I personally thought and think is the most credible and the most genuine, the person with the least stakes in the game, who has wisdom and looks like your aunt. You know what I mean? Like, she's a very trustworthy looking human. Her delivery and how she talks is very believable. You know, it's this is not somebody who's trying to make some money off of this situation. She's got no ducks in the race. You know what I mean? And so her wisdom and her whole aura, I really wanted that to come across. And it just so happened that the location had these beautiful vaulted trees on both sides, these, like, you know, old wisdom trees almost, you know, so putting her against that background to come in, you know, starting with the close-up on the cane, all of these signals of wisdom, of maturity, of accomplishment, of status, you know, status in the sense of like a pure human, not material, obviously. This is somebody that you'd respect if you saw her in the grocery store and anywhere else. And so, you know, again, that's a small stylistic thing. It's also kind of creepy, but it's really to draw you into the storytelling and to what is about to happen.
Well, Marcus, I really appreciate you spending some time with me today and like sharing your experiences and little things that weren't in the part of the show. And taking a different look at it. I thank you very much for that.
Absolutely. And thanks for having me on the podcast, man. I really appreciate having the time to talk about this.
I want to thank Marcus for that fantastic interview. With what went on with No Ride Home, and it really hit home to Marcus. And this is why Black Lives Matter movement is so important. Even during the filming of No Ride Home, the thickness of the racism in the air, even in today's time, is unacceptable. Them not even looking in the shed that was there during the investigation is after Alonzo's murder, and I'm going to call it a murder, and you have the FBI and everybody involved in that didn't look in the shed. Now, if this was a prominent white person, I believe that shed would have been overturned. I mean, they would have went through that with a toothbrush to try to find out the clues. It's unacceptable. And Marcus growing up as a black man and all his accomplishments during his life is, to me, I love doing stories like this. I really do. That's why I did an extensive background check on Marcus. You know, I just didn't want to know the man everybody knows out there as a great director. And I want to see where he came from. You know, the inside of his soul. What he had to deal with. And that leads you. When you get a person with that kind of background. And so when it's brought to light with his work, the work he does, the people he's worked with, and I want to thank Spike Lee for giving Marcus a chance, you know, so he can bring forth to the world his talent, his vision, you know, and the people around Marcus, Doug Sackman, Justin Jenowitz, and tons of other people that worked on the set that I didn't interview and didn't mention, you know, the lighting and the costumes and getting the scene right and the time and of 1969, things were different back then, a lot different. But you know, the racism still exists today. It didn't go nowhere. It's still here, you know. And I want to thank Marcus. Really, I really do. I really did enjoy this interview. I have been getting a lot of emails like, "Let's get back to the ghosts. Let's get back to the spirits and get off this UFO stuff." And you know, and we will. I've got two more parts of my 8-part series. I'll be back in 2 weeks with the roundtable episode of the Berkshires. Don't miss that. I really pulled out some old guests and paranormal investigators and podcast hosts and their views and opinions and questions on the Berkshires episode. You don't want to miss that one. That some very interesting questions. And if you haven't watched the Berkshires or No Ride Home, or Mystery on a Rooftop, make sure you catch those on the new Netflix Unsolved Mysteries. It's really, really a great series. Thank you, Marcus Clark, Justin Jenowitz, Doug Sackman. Those episodes were released in 2020. Next week, I'll have my second part of my look back on the Berkshires, which will feature Melanie Kirchdorfer, Tom Reed, and Tom Warner. Then a week after that, I will play the roundtable. Kind of wraps up the Berkshires series I did back 5 years ago. We're coming up upon the 56th anniversary of when this UFO phenomena happened. Can't believe it, 1969, September 1st. Wow. Join me next week. Yeah, we're going to follow up on this 3-part series with another 3-part series. Then the conclusion. Then in September, I'll be back with some new episodes on Ghost in the Valley podcast. We'll be right back.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need. You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.